This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, day one of impeachment trial 2.0, and was not exactly inherent the wind. Trump's problems with getting competent legal representation persist. I mean, he did have competent legal representation in impeachment trial 1.0, but the performance of counselors, Castor in particular, and Schoen yesterday left many wanting, including many Trump-supporting Republican senators. Well, why was that? Well, because you just didn't do the paint-by-numbers that you have to do to get on the other side of this matter and secure an acquittal.
Right, but in their defense, they haven't been there that long. I mean, they were hired, what, last week? I mean, they didn't have a lot of time to prepare.
And so what? All of the arguments that need to be made exist in the public arena. You could cut and paste any Alan Dershowitz interview, including the one I did with him 2 weeks ago, and use that for your defense, particularly on the matter yesterday, the only matter being jurisdiction and whether or not the Senate has jurisdiction to convene a trial for a president out of office. That was the issue at bar. So why Bruce Castor went off on his love of senators for 5-7 minutes. What was that?
I mean, filling time. I don't know. I thought he was going to get out a cake recipe next and start going through that. You take a half a cup of water. I mean, honestly, it was so, the meandering was just little.
Filling time. This is, you have 45 minutes. You don't need to use all your time. This is about making a cogent argument. And this is in part what we got. I mean, literally, a 5-7 minute riff bootlicking senators.
Senators of the United States, they're not ordinary people. They're extraordinary people, in the technical sense, extraordinary people.
And they're people who need people.
And then he talked about listening to Everett Dirksen's speeches on his record player growing up. And he offered plaudits for senators like Byrd and Mansfield and Dole, great men who were great speechifiers.
Senators really are different. And I have been around United States senators before. Two of them in this room from Pennsylvania, I like to think, are friendly toward me, or at least friends of mine when we're not politically adverse. And I have been around their predecessors. And one thing I have discovered, whether it be Democrats or Republicans, United States senators are patriots first. Patriots first. They love their country. They love their families. They love the states that they represent. There isn't a member in this room who has not used the term, I represent the great state of fill in the blank. Why? Because they're all great? Yeah. But you think yours is greater than others because these are your people.
Oh, my God. Who the hell cares? Can you make a point that's relevant to this proceeding rather than just genuflecting before the senators? You're sidling up to them for what point? Oh, that Bruce Castor, he's a nice guy. Is that your job there?
Honey, let's invite him over for dinner. 312-642-5600, turnkey dot pro, answer line 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I mean, it really was asinine. And he, rather than complimenting, frankly, Jamie Raskin, Maryland congressman who is one of the House managers, gave the argument yesterday as to jurisdiction. Rather than complimenting him and, again, supplicating yourself before him like you did all the U.S. senators, separate out, which he sort of did, but he was just meandering all over the place. He did for a moment separate out the facts and the law from the sentimentalism that Raskin offered and that the Democrats are offering with their video montage of what happened on the Capitol on January 16th, what happened at the Capitol on January 6th. What? Because the point is, that's a fascinating 13-minute montage you played, Representative Raskin, and it's completely irrelevant because there's no argument being offered in defense of it. There's no argument being offered in defense of any of the violence that was displayed in that 13-minute montage. Nobody is defending it. Nobody, including the former president. So what's your point?
Well, they were trying to prove that he...
I know what they were trying to do, and my point is to say the response should have been, what is your point? This is sophistry. That is not a legal argument. That is an emotional appeal. Sans the underlying facts, sans any relevance to the legal issues we are debating here on this day. Should have gone right after them, right between the eyes. And by the way, this is not just my opinion. Alan Dershowitz on Newsmax in real time watching Castor's 45-minute stemwinder had this to say.
There is no argument. I have no idea what he's doing. I have no idea why he's saying what he's saying. You know, he's introducing himself. I'm a nice guy. I like my senators. I know my senators. Senators are great people. Come on. The American people are entitled to an argument, a constitutional argument. I suspect it will be forthcoming from David Schoen. But this, just after all kinds of very strong presentations on the part of the House managers with the videotapes and the emotional speech by Congressman Raskin, my former student, you get up there and you respond. We know that hard cases make bad law. I probably would have started with that. This is a hard case. This is an emotional case. He did say, and I think very appropriately, that everybody wants to take revenge when they see a horrible event that took place at the Capitol. But then he went off. I just don't understand it.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll bring it home. But right now, it does not appear to me to be effective advocacy. He may know the senators better than I do. Maybe they want to be buttered up. Maybe they want to be told what great people they are and how he knows two senators. But boy, it's not the kind of argument I would have made. I have to tell you that.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. I got to tell you, it's frustrating when people who you believe are being mistreated get terrible representation. And frankly, in the case of President Trump, are responsible for their terrible representation. It's frustrating when people you're supportive of can't clear the competence hurdle. And by the way, it wasn't just the stemwinders and the obsequiousness that was problematic with Castor. It was also when he actually did try to make legal arguments, generally speaking, maybe with the exception, and what Dershowitz is referring to, I agree with, but that wasn't a legal argument. But Castor talking about arguing why this issue is moot.
Let's understand why we are really here. We are really here because the majority in the House of Representatives does not want to face Donald Trump as a political rival in the future. That's the real reason we're here. And that's why they have to get over the jurisdictional hurdle, which they can't get over. But that's why they have to get over that in order to get to the part of the Constitution that allows removal. So that's the nobody says it that plainly. But unfortunately, I have a way of speaking that way. And the reason that I am having trouble with the argument is the American people just spoke, and they just changed administrations. So in the light most favorable to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle here, their system works. The people are smart enough, in the light most favorable to them, they're smart enough to pick a new administration if they don't like the old one. And they just did. And he's down there at Pennsylvania Avenue now, probably wondering, how come none of my stuff is happening up at the Capitol?
Yeah, he's probably not wondering that because he supports this trial, right. Counselor, number one. Number two, your political analysis is wrong. And number three, the fact that President Biden was elected does not make the issue moot. that the whole point is to say you have a president out of office. Does the Senate, per the Constitution, have reach there? That's the argument. So the fact that he's out of office is the predicate to have the argument. It's not a response to the issue at bar.
You can't impeach a private citizen. Did we hear that? No. Is President Trump or former President Trump paying Bruce Castor? Is he doing this pro bono? Because if I was paying for that kind of representation, I would want my money back.
Jim in Crown Point.
You know, I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV. But you give me 20 minutes, I could get a case going that would dispute everything. This is emotion. They have no constitutional basis, so it's all emotion. So you go after the other side, Maxine Waters, Schumer, all of them talk violence. This is not a constitutional contest here. But these guys are, you know, no. This lawyer sounds like the lawyer from My Cousin Vinny. The stuttering lawyer. That's who he is.
Thanks for the call. Oh, yeah, the prosecutor rather than Joe Pesci. Maybe Joe Pesci would have been better representation. A TV lawyer could have done a better job. I mean, again, these arguments have been laid bare over the last several weeks. Just cut and paste the Twitter feed from former appellate court justice Michael Luttig, for God's sakes, making the case as to why you cannot try a president once he is out of office. Just cut and paste that and present that. Yeah. I mean, again, here, people are basically locked in. The Senate is basically locked in. So what you have to do is be incompetent to do something egregious in order to move any votes here. And Castor and Schoen, to a lesser extent, moved a vote yesterday. They moved Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, a Republican, from the Senate doesn't have jurisdiction to the Senate does.
Yet if you listen to it, it speaks for itself. It was disorganized, random, had nothing. They talked about many things, but they didn't talk about the issue at hand. And so if I'm an impartial juror and I'm trying to make a decision based upon the facts as presented on this issue, then the House managers did a much better job.
Senator, how about the video of the mob attack on the Capitol?
That is not the issue at hand. The issue at hand is it constitutional to impeach a president who's left office? And the House managers made a compelling, cogent case, and the president's team did not.
I don't think the House managers made a particularly compelling case. I think there are good arguments on both sides of this issue. I think it's a close call whether the Senate does have the constitutional authority to try a president out of office, but that's not the point. The point is, all you have to do is offer sort of gentleman sees recitation of the arguments on these matters right down the line. Jurisdictional, First Amendment, and if you want to include institutional norms or some sort of normative appeal to these institutionalists in the Senate, fine. But that and call the question.
Yeah, I mean, Castro, this was one part because I watched the entire thing. Where he suggested if President Trump did something wrong, go arrest him.
This idea of a January amnesty is nonsense. If my colleagues on this side of the chamber actually think that President Trump committed a criminal offense, after he's out of office, you go and arrest him.
Well, that's true. You can. Yeah, that's true. That's right. I mean, that's to some extent, that's a fair response to the January exception case that Raskin was making. Yeah, right. You're saying he incited a riot. You're saying that he has blood on his hands. You're saying that what this 13-minute video represents is President Trump's handiwork. And he is culpable for what happened. Well, if he cannot be just politically culpable, but not legally culpable if he incited the riot or if he conspired, even worse. So, yes, you always have that option. If he did something if he committed a criminal offense, to arrest him. He's not immune from that. Larry and Bartlett.
Hey, excuse me. Good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, I'm trying to remember what I learned in civics in grammar school about 60 years ago, isn't it the responsibility of the judicial branch of the government to decide if something is constitutional or not constitutional, not the Senate, for God's sake?
Yeah, well, thanks for the call there. Yes, but the Supreme Court hasn't weighed in on this particular issue, and impeachment doesn't need to wait for it to weigh in. And so you have a political process that's tackling a constitutional issue. By the way, I got a text. Aren't Trump's lawyers Dems? Are they sabotaging Trump? Stop. Stop. These are lawyers that Trump selected. This is like going back to Trump's legal team post-election. These are Trump lawyers Trump selected, or in other words, gave aid and comfort to, in the case of Sidney Powell and for a while Lynn Wood. So stop it. He has agency, for goodness sakes. He's a former president of the United States. These are his choices that he's making. He's responsible for the kind of representation he gets and what he does based on the kind of representation he gets. So stop with the conspiracy theories about he's being undermined from within. If he is, then he's at it's at his own hands, for goodness sakes. How about an appeal to competence?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You're talking about day one of impeachment 2.0, and we're talking about the arguments that were offered by both the House managers as well as Trump's defense team, Castor and Schoen. David Schoen, sort of workmanlike, but did offer at least something tangible after a, sort of an opening foundational statement. He made the due process argument.
With this trial, you will open up new and bigger wounds across the nation, for a great many Americans see this process for exactly what it is, a chance by a group of partisan politicians seeking to eliminate Donald Trump from the American political scene and seeking to disenfranchise 74 million plus American voters and those who dare to share their political beliefs and vision of America.
He got beyond Trump to Trump voters, which was good. Also, but it runs counter to Bruce Castor spending so much time talking about how great all these senators are and what patriots they are. Oh, and they're also partisan hacks, his co-counsel says right after him. But the due process argument he lodged, which is a good one, again, jurisdiction, due process, First Amendment.
The denial of due process in this case, of course, starts with the House of Representatives. In this unprecedented snap impeachment process, the House of Representatives denied every attribute of fundamental constitutional due process that Americans correctly have come to believe is part of what makes this country so great. How and why did that happen? It is a function of the insatiable lust for impeachment in the House for the past 4 years.
Yeah, it's not fair. It's not fair play. They're not they're not upfront, reliable, forthright actors. And then he played a montage to respond to Jamie Raskin's montage of all of the pronouncements from Democrats starting 20 minutes into the Trump administration and actually going before there was the Zelensky call that led to impeachment 1.0. Of all the times they said that president should be impeached, let's move to articles of impeachment, everything under the sun, remember everything from because he passed tax cuts to emolument to goofy arguments about emoluments from AOC and the like to just everything under the sun, the kitchen sink. It was impeachment, impeachment, impeachment all the time. And I think that it was an important point to make. It was a useful montage to show that these are political hacks. This is a politicized process and it's personal. It is not on the merits with respect to the facts or the law. That was helpful.
Right. But
overall, between the two of them, It was not a command performance. It was largely a counterproductive performance, I thought, number one. And, you know, this goes back. We talked to George Perry, who's a former federal and state prosecutor in Philadelphia, last week. He knows Bruce Castor. And, he was right in sort of describing him as he's not going to wow you.
Yep.
You know, he's competent. He's sort of workmanlike, but he's not going to wow you. Well, he didn't wow me, and he wasn't competent or workmanlike. It was just sort of a hot mess from Bruce Castor.
And then what else, Schoen, what he did that was, I thought, pretty impressive, was talked about that 13-minute video that was played.
We now learn that the House managers, in their wisdom, have hired a movie company and a large law firm to create, manufacture, and splice for you a package designed by experts to chill and horrify you.
Did you see it is that way? Because I watched the 13-minute video, and I was horrified by what happened and what didn't happen, and that Trump should have he inserted himself, I think, a lot earlier in the day to try and stop that. I mean, you know, I know seven people died, but it's horrible that seven people died. One officer lost three fingers.
Wait. Seven people died. Can we just hold on a second with this? An officer was killed, Officer Sicknick.
Right.
Ashley Babbitt, one of the rioters, was shot and killed. There's two. Then you had three people who died from medical emergencies, heart attacks, and so forth. That is a stretch to start categorizing Officer Sicknick or even Ashley Babbitt in the same category, to put them in the same category as people who had a health event.
Worse. Then it's two police officers who committed suicide days after the attack. They lopped them in.
I know, but you're making that case. You're the one using seven, not them. So why are you using
seven?
No,
they were using... Raskin said seven yesterday. I watched the...
So why are you repeating it?
I'm saying that it's dumb to include they should have said two people passed away that day. Not the one who had a heart attack while he was walking to his van. I'm sorry that he's gone, but that was just a medical emergency. He wasn't trampled. He was just going to move the van, and he...
Yeah, you know...
Somebody else had a stroke.
All the particulars are... It's just... This is the forest... The twigs for the forest. We understand there was violence committed that day. We've seen a lot of video of it prior to yesterday's montage. So now you're finding your, you know, outrage switch?
Well, it's disgusting. Those are not my Republicans. Those are not the Republicans I associate with. Or a lot of us don't associate with them. And people need to know that, because we're getting blamed just because we're Republicans. Blamed for that, insurrection on January 6th. It's everyone's fault.
Why don't you also tell us how you're not a white supremacist?
I'm not.
Right. Anything else you want to tell us that you're not? That they accuse you of being? Are you responsible for killing 460,000 people? Do you want to deny that too?
Yes.
Do you want to play their game? They call you a name, or they accuse you of something, and you defensively, I'm not that person. I agree. I'm not even going to dignify that. You do not have, you, Jamie Raskin, Democrats, do not have any moral high ground on political violence on January 6th or in general. There is no debate here because there's no disagreement. The only difference is, as we talked about in the wake of January 6th, is we, unlike you, Jamie Raskin, to push back, have been consistent in our opposition to political violence, whether it comes in the form of Antifa and Black Lives Matter, or whether it comes in the form of those rioters, some of whom are Trump supporters, on January 6th at the Capitol. Stop apologizing for who you are. Nick in Des Moines, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi there. Yeah, I mean, just wildly incompetent. And honestly, I'm getting sick of hearing about, like, just hearing about Trump being the greatest thing since sliced bread is just really grinding my gears lately. You know, this isn't the first time that we've had an issue, like this lawyer's having a horrible performance yesterday. What about, like, Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci? You know, they basically shoved Dr. Atlas around the entire time, and they let those two set the stage for how we were going to deal with COVID. You know, or how about his awful, horrible performance in the first debate? He has a lot of things that he's messed up here, and I'm ready to move on from him. Like I said before, I'm ready to move on.
That's fine. That's fair, Nick. Thanks for the call. The people he surrounded himself with, it's a recurring issue. Michael Cohen and all these other goofballs and incompetents. And that the travesty that was his legal representation for the 6 weeks following the election. And I said it during and gave them quarter. Go ahead, make your arguments. You're making big claims. Let's see what you got. And they had nothing. nothing that they could put together in any sort of cogent form so that it could be assimilated either by the public or a court of law or preferably both. They failed. And I scored, oh, blah, 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 this, this, and this. Your competence matters. Your actual performance matters. I thought that's what we believed. And the reason I'm not ready to move on from Trump is not because of Trump per se, but because of this is using, this is a witch hunt, to borrow a Trumpism, for the purposes of getting past Trump to Trump voters. And I don't think there's enough appreciation for that. You may be ready to move on from Trump, but they will not absolve you of your role in vote, your role in the Trump administration by just the simple act of voting for him once or twice. You're not absolved. You don't have the green light to reenter civil society. That's the play here. It's not limited to Trump. And I keep repeating this because I don't think it's penetrated deeply enough in the general 74 million person Trump universe. Ed in Oak Brook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I mean, I watched the performance while I was actually working, and I was disgusted by it. I always thought lawyers were so cool and calm and professional because you see them on TV and blah, blah, blah. I don't know where they got these guys. But I'm wondering who is actually paying for the Senate, let's call it the offense, and then who's paying for Trump's defense? If me, you, and everybody in America is paying for the Senate, well, they got unlimited amount of money. They could put on anything that they want, that production thing that they put together.
Well, they're house managers.
If Trump is, yeah, well, okay, so the federal government is coming down on a U.S. citizen, and guess what? U.S. citizen always loses against the government because the government's got just so much more money.
This is not a resource issue. It's not a resource issue.
Well, it kind of is because I don't think Trump has as much as you guys are thinking he is. And then the other thing is these Republicans that are voting against, let's say, for the impeachment, like Nami, that lady from Alaska, they're the biggest traitors of them all, and they disgust me to the core. You'll never see a Democrat go against another Democrat, and that's why the Republican Party is so weak. And that last guy he just called, he's given up on Trump. Okay, go ahead, give up on Trump. You know what? Give up on your free speech, too, because if you say anything against these Democrats or if you say anything that the election was stolen, guess what? You're censored. So go ahead, crawl in your shell, my friend from Iowa, because that's exactly what's going to happen. They're going to put you in a shell.
Thanks for the call. I don't know that he's crawling in a shell, but yeah, I agree with you that you have to look past Trump to what the attitude is toward Trump voters. I'll just say it again. And by the way, you think you denounced the violence at the Capitol? Or did you send out any tweets? Did you post anything on Facebook that was supportive of Trump? Sorry. You're a violent extremist. Knock, knock on your door.
Yeah.
You think I'm being hyperbolic? It's happening right now.
I have a friend who owns a tattoo shop. He was there. He didn't even march to the Capitol. And 312 Antifa, that's a group, they've been vandalizing his place every single day. I think we're going to have him on tomorrow or Friday, but he wants to tell his story. And he's like, I wasn't even there. I was just supporting Trump. I was not a part of any violence. And they are destroying his livelihood.
Yeah, well, Antifa is one thing. I'm talking about knock, knock on your door from law enforcement.
Ooh.
That's happening right now with part of the investigations into those who were responsible or believed to be responsible for some of the violence at the Capitol. So you were in a social media chat with somebody who we've now charged or a person of interest with respect to some of the violence that occurred at the Capitol. Knock, knock on your door. Greg in LaGrange.
Morning, guys. Dan, Amy, when I heard that interview with George Perry on your show, Dan, old boy went off in my head. I thought he was being kind. I thought he was being very dismissive, but being very kind in saying it. And then when I heard the presentation yesterday, I was just like, it's like straight up Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It's like, get to the point.
It makes it so much more interesting for the listener to have a point. Yes, right.
Right. I mean, it was absolutely horrible. And the thing that really bothers me in all of this is when they foist the dead in their arguments, and every dead person, everybody that died during this is a casualty of this, no matter how it happened to me as a Christian. But we seem to forget the people like David Dorn and Patrick Underwood.
Yeah.
Where were they? Where were they mentioned? Where were they, except from very, very, very few outlets that would mention their names? They seem to be forgotten. There's violence everywhere. It happens every day. People, innocent people are being killed. We should be focusing on the overall ball of violence that we have forming in this country and find a way to solve it.
Thanks for the call, Greg. And I want to get to Jamie Raskin, too, because, you know, this is, of course, being celebrated, but I don't think it should be. And maybe that makes me cold and heartless. I can live with it. Jamie Raskin on his daughter, Tabitha, at the tender age of 24, doesn't want to go back to the Capitol after what happened.
And when they were finally rescued over an hour later by Capitol officers and we were together, I hugged them and I apologized and I told my daughter, Tabitha, who's 24 and a brilliant algebra teacher in Teach for America. Now, I told her how sorry I was, and I promised her that it would not be like this again the next time she came back to the Capitol with me. And you know what she said? She said, "Dad, I don't want to come back to the Capitol again." Of all the terrible, brutal things I saw and I heard on that day, and since then, that one hit me the hardest.
And Bruce Castor, one of Trump's attorneys, thinks that deserves a compliment? That sort of sophistry? Did that move people? Did that move you, Amy?
No, you know what? I turned on when he was talking about his son, his middle son dying, Tommy, and I'm like, I thought I had the wrong station. I'm like, what is going on here? And then I sat with it and watched and then realized his son passed away the week before, suicide, I believe.
Yeah, that's right.
But what does that have to do with anything? I mean, it's exactly. Just pulling at your heartstrings. It was, you know, it was a daytime soap opera. Like, oh, great, that's what this has turned into. Yeah. And I'm sorry for his loss. Obviously, everybody is. But that had nothing to do with Trump is on trial.
24-year-old Tabitha won't come back to the Capitol.
She's a teacher. She's a woman. She's a grown woman. Please stop it. Stop it. It's not like she's a 12-year-old kid who had to hide under a desk.
But this is the infantilization of adults that is the calling card of the left. Oh, and by the way, for the banging on the doors and, you know, all of the Ben Matlock drama he tried to infuse in the process. And it would have been nice if one of the attorneys said, well, that's interesting. And it was terrible what happened. It was also terrible when you had people running through the neighborhoods in Kenosha, banging on people's homes, banging on their front doors of their home. Why is the nation supposed to be fixated exclusively when it's politicians who are under threat as opposed to when it's ordinary Americans who are under threat?
They just care about themselves. Here's Representative, I'm going to butcher his name, but Cicilline.
Things could have been much worse. As one senator said, they could have killed all of us.
They could have been much worse, and the one thing we know they will never be with Congress is they also could have been better. Randy in Crown Point.
Amy, you don't normally get to me that I ended that a few years ago, but you got to me this morning. Your idea that I'm not like them is the problem, and I don't say want to offend you in that, but they believe you're like that whether you are like that. That's why, as a group of Republicans, conservatives, we have to stay united in the message, because 74 million of us, as Dan has aptly brought out, 74 million of us, they want to eliminate. They want to retrain us. They want to reteach us. I studied history growing up. And the history of Russia and the re-education camps, and China does it now. That's where the left looks at people like you, whether you believe, whether you are like that or not. Because you pulled the lever for that man, because you support, because you ever said any one good thing about that man, you should be retrained. They've been saying it for a long time now, and you, so you've got to stand up and fight with the rest of us. Now, I'm not saying go to Capitol Hill. Quite frankly, I wouldn't go to the Capitol because I don't think they do the people's business anyway. Raskin's daughter, what's she doing there? Is that her job? Or is she a school teacher out of work? There's so many side stories to this. But the number one thing, Amy, you got to stay united. No, you're not an insurrectionist, if you want to call that an insurrection. No, you're not a murderer. But they believe you are because you supported the Trump world and the MAGA world. And
thanks for the call, Randy. I get it. You know, the idea is somebody commits an act of violence based in their religion. Does that impugn the religion? If a Christian commits murder, says God told me to do it, does that mean Christianity is bad? No. But I voted for Trump because I thought he was the best choice for president of the United States. Now I'm responsible for anything anybody does in under his banner, in his name. Honestly or dishonestly? Hardly.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Chicago Teachers Union rank and file approved the deal to phase in their return to school, at least for kids pre-K through 8th grade over the next several weeks. Although I have to note,
what
the CTU said, 54% of its roughly 25,000 members approved a tentative agreement to return to the classroom. 54% of 25,000? Does that leave you feeling confident about your teachers and your school and your classroom when it's a 50-50 split after all this time, even with all of those triggers to shut down schools again, that half the teachers in CPS still really don't want to go back?
312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Yeah, not a lot of people celebrating, Dan, who've got kids at in middle school at CPS because they know that if just three kids in the entire school get COVID, they're going to shut it all down again. And I think that Jesse Sharkey and the CTU members are cheering that on. They want that to happen. I'm surprised that they want somebody to get hospitalized in a Catholic school to prove that we were right. But you know what? They were wrong. And they are a bunch of, you know what, pee hat wearers for not sucking it up and going back a month. We've lost a month of in-person learning because of this fighting back and forth. It's not a victory.
Our members have to read it, discuss, and ultimately take a decision about what's going to happen next.
I mean, and he's going to run for mayor, by the way, and so is Stacey Davis Gates, just in case you care, because they're doing such a fine job.
Everybody's going to run for mayor. Everybody's going to run for everything. That is the most tiresome conversation in Illinois politics. How about pulling back and talking about the city more generally, since so few people actually care about the Chicago public school system? I don't want to belabor the point on something most people don't care about. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. My sense of it is that most people don't care about the Chicago public school system.
Yeah, we're the bottom of the barrel. They're poor. Poor minority kids. Nobody cares.
Oh, what about the city of Chicago generally? Do people even care about that anymore? I'm not sure. A good piece you turned me on to, Amy, Chicago Contrarian, where you had some business executives that you will not appear on the pages of Cranes, their comments, according to the business magazine for people who hate business, Crane, Chicago Business. Well, they were giving the unfiltered version of the truth of Chicago from a business person's perspective. And it was interesting. They didn't want their names disclosed for all sorts of obvious reasons because, you know, people for some reason are still
people are afraid.
Cowed by the machine and politicians in the state. They don't want to I don't know, demonstrate any leadership.
Right. They're too afraid of Mayor Lightfoot, and that pertains to sports, but we'll get to that in a little bit.
What a terrible way to live your life. I'll tell you what, if you're too afraid of Mayor Lightfoot, you have bigger issues to examine and tackle than the state of your business or your kid's school. I got to tell you that. Too afraid of this and too afraid of that. What a way to live life in constant fear of everything. Just give me a little bit of comfort and I will cede all
power to you.
Power of my lives and the lives of my kids. Yeah.
And that's what okay.
The executives, you know, who try to lay most of the blame with Preckwinkle and Fox and pretend that Lightfoot has, you know, good intentions. She just can't figure it out. But she's, you know, got these roadblocks from Preckwinkle and Fox. It's funny. Again, we're going to provide cover for her, even though she provides cover for Preckwinkle and Fox. You see how it is?
Yeah.
It's just remarkable. But hey, she's a good one. So desperate for hope. So desperate to participate in the self-delusion. The person that you're defending is the person flacking for the people you're not defending. Okay. Work that logic. Talking about footprint for commercial real estate. The footprint of required commercial space could shrink by 50% or more for typical white-collar office environment. One consultant noted, if you could short Chicago commercial office space, this would be the time to do it. And he makes the additional point, and this is a good one, that the thinking now may be, the impact of the lawlessness and the pandemic closures is less severe than originally anticipated. But he makes the point, look, a lot of businesses hold long-term leases. Our conversations with business owners suggest that unless prices drop precipitously, many firms will opt out of lease renewals altogether. In other words, it's too soon to call victory on the pandemic impact on city coffers from business, not to mention property values in the private real estate market, if that's something you care about. I know most people just care about government. We look at everything through the prism of government. But I try to remind people that there are actually private interests that are worth contemplating as well. You know, your residential and commercial property owners, for example. At the center of concern among executives is rising crime, especially highly visible crime such as carjackings and armed assaults in and around Michigan Avenue and the Loop. It's this topic that Cranes and the mainstream press fails to write about and certainly fails to conduct any substantive investigative reporting on. If an assailant pulls a gun on me, I can get over it. My wallet is just cards and cash. My car is just a car, says one executive in the media business. But if it happens to my employees, clients, or suppliers who are visiting our office, I would never forgive myself if we could have held a meeting virtually instead, especially if they could not respond with a level head and just give them what they want quickly. So now he makes the point that we've made on this show many a time, where it's not the West Side or the South Side. It's not localized. The violent crime problem is just a Chicago writ large problem, and it doesn't matter if you're on the Mag Mile or if you're on one of the shooting galleries, neighborhoods that have been turned into shooting galleries on the South Side or the West Side. But there's a response. Don't worry. Mayor Lightfoot, who they're flacking for in the same breath. This is why I just can't muster much optimism for the situation. Here's the response from Mayor Lightfoot's police department, because it's hers, just like it's her school district. Operation Safe Pump. Operation Safe Pump.
Yeah, they want...
It's a response to carjacking.
Yeah, they want police officers to take shifts, and if you see a senior citizen pumping gas, they want them to get out of their car and pump the gas for them, so they're gas attendants now, to make sure that they don't get carjacked. I mean, is it... Any police officers out there, too, we'd love to hear from you if you're going to be, you know, become a gas station attendant. 312-642-5600, Turnkey Depro, answer line 64636, type in DA, and a quick comment. I tweeted it out yesterday.
Alderman Ray Lopez tweeted this out. He's the one who's gotten into, you know, profanity-laced back and forth with Lightfoot, triple threat. Operation Safe Pump, this is from his deputy chief, Bureau of Patrol, Area 4, Chicago Police Department, Ernesto Cato III. District TAC teams, community engagements can bring some security to motorists during this crisis of vehicular hijacking. Well, it's interesting. The police are calling it a crisis of vehicular hijacking. by simply pumping gas for seniors. Each district should assign 2 tech cars to a gas station for 30 minutes to 1 hour and pump gas for senior citizens. Operation Safe Pump is in effect. So the police officers, in addition to being law enforcement officials, in addition to being psychologists, in addition to being family counselors, now, as you said, Amy, they're gas station attendants.
Yeah, it's like treating officers like kindergartners, collecting stars for a class pizza party. That's what the alderman tweeted out, too.
Well, I don't know if it's exactly like that. I would look at it the other way. I mean, this is your response to violent crime because you won't interdict and prosecute violent criminals.
Exactly. The reason why so many teenagers are carjackings, first of all, because they should be in high school, hello, but also, too, they'll get a slap on the wrist, possibly a misdemeanor. But if their older cousin does it, then he's going to go to jail. It's ridiculous. And I just got a text message from a police officer in Jefferson Park. Amy, I thought this was a joke when I saw it, but this is real. And I don't
officer
know if they're
safe.
Gonna
Operation Safe Pump. by the way, is it just seniors that are being carjacked? I don't think so.
No.
So they
should be pumping gas. If they're going to pump gas, if this is Operation Safe Pump, they should do it for everyone.
Now, with Operation Safe Pump, I have questions. I get them to do the windshields, too? I mean, while you're
at it.
What
about checking the oil? I mean, but there's the brake fluid, you know, it's just...
Right.
And the pressure in the tires. I mean, what are you going to do?
Right, exactly. I think the tire on the front tire on the passenger side is... A couple pounds light, could you? Op-ed is relevant. It's from Minneapolis because it's not just a Chicago problem. It's just perhaps most acute in Chicago. Why I am one of many former Minneapolis Police Department officers who has retired. Right, I'm a former Minneapolis Police Department. This is an op-ed in the Star Tribune by a police officer, former police officer now, I suppose, named Kim Voss. She had 37 years on the job. I didn't retire because I wanted to retire, despite many thinking 37 years was enough. I didn't feel as I was done just yet. I still had a mission to complete, and that is what makes leaving difficult. While our leadership has our back and we remained unsupported by our state, our city, and our police administration, our neighborhoods burned. We felt helpless. To add insult to injury, they gave up our home and called it just bricks and mortar, the precinct. It wasn't just bricks and mortar to us. If you really want to totally break down the morale and mission of police officers, hold them back and leave them hanging without any support. What you're left with is a department that sees almost one-third of its sworn personnel leave due to PTSD, both diagnosed and undiagnosed. I am one of those. It's hard to get up every day and be happy to go to your job feeling like damaged goods. I received over 4,000 voicemails, 4,000, of vitriolic hate, and I didn't have a phone left or a desk to put a phone on. My office had been firebombed. The people now being touted as peaceful protesters hacked the city's email and subscribed me to more than 1,000 online sites. And she goes on to talk, I've done everything from signing petitions to abolish the death penalty to subscribing to the Harvard Law Review, and also... I am on Cowgirl 911 and FarmersOnly.com now because of the hackers.
It's our time.
She just goes on to talk about what she described in general terms that I read to you with more specificity over in terms of what happened in Minneapolis since the George Floyd killing and now what the posture is of the civilian political authorities. Tell me that's any different in Chicago.
And real quick, I just want to say one thing about CPS Sports starting again. Mm-hmm. The news came just one day after Mayor Lightfoot's comments at a news conference revealed she was unaware that the rest of the state was playing sports. I found out that our CPS Sports directors, the guys running the show, the men, were afraid of Lightfoot to ask, you know, during this delicate time whether or not we could start up with sports. But I wasn't afraid, and I'm so glad when they told me to leave that press conference that I sat there and said, arrest me, I'm not leaving. Because if I had left, Dan, their video feed that they had was broken. So I recorded that on my cell phone. And to let the world know, or not the world, but Chicago know, and these men in charge of CPS Sports, that she had no idea that we had received clearance a week prior. So we lost a week, almost 2 weeks of playing winter sports for not just basketball, but boys swimming, gymnastics, cheer, dance, bowling, badminton. And because they were afraid to approach her, to even ask her, to fight for our kids.
Right. And we're supposed to believe that she didn't know.
She
We're
didn't
supposed
know.
To believe her feigning of ignorance.
No, I honest to God,
she's a,
think
she's
she
a
doesn't
sports
know.
Nut. She's a sports nut. So which is it?
I'm telling you, she's surrounding herself too with children. Everyone in her, you know, in her office is resigned or left, moved on. Mm-hmm. She's not even halfway through her first term, so she's got children around her. Which I gave them unsolicited advice that you need to, you know, I don't agree with any of her policy making, but if you work for her, you can't. She looked like a fool the other day. It was
There's
embarrassing.
No question about that. There's no question about that.
Talking about, and I want my daughter to get back. Like, what? Your daughter goes to a Catholic school. Catholic schools are already playing sports. What is going on here?
It could be.
The blind leading the blind.
This is just a shot in the dark. I don't know if this is true or not, because I don't know if it's ever happened. She could just be lying.
You made Mike Scott laugh.
Officer Dan in Chicago. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yes, good morning. Yes, I'm calling because I'm a Chicago police officer. However, I'm retiring this year because of the way the department is being run. It's not run by Brown. It's run by Mayor Lightfoot. And I blame also the court system for these high juvenile carjackings, because these kids, I mean, a few of them have been, they were on house arrest or they were on probation for the same offense, and they're back out there doing it. And the sad thing is that they're not being held accountable. I mean, I think that the law should be tougher on them. They're being used as a sociological type of experiment, so to speak, or dilemma, so to speak. Instead of being charged as an adult for these crimes, they're being let out, and they're doing it again, terrorizing the citizens of Chicago. And, you know,
Officer, we're all being used as part of a sociological experiment, but it's not even so much a sociological experiment. It's that people are the means to political ends. So these criminals, repeat offenders, are the means to certain political ends. And, spilling a little blood, allowing a little blood to be spilt in furtherance of their political ends. Well, that's just the price of doing business. Sorry.
I mean, I was a DCFS caseworker way before I ever became the police. And it just, you know, the system back then was tattered. Now it's far worse.
Thank you, sir.
And congratulations on your retirement.
Yeah.
He's getting out.
Why don't we pull a New Jersey and go back to mandatory gas station attendants? You can't pump your own gas.
Oh, that's right.
That'd be a job creator too. Now,
but
of course,
they'd have to wear bulletproof vest.
And these gas stations would probably close on the added expense. But you know, again, you're gonna break a few eggs.
Yeah.
Vic on the north side.
Yeah, about the policeman going out pumping gas. You know, it's taking the public servant description too far. All you have to do is just give them a roll call, tell them just to drive up by the gas station, pay particular attention to gas stations, give them some special attention. You don't have to get out of the car and be that. Next thing, they'll be checking tire pressure, you know.
Well, right. Here's the other thing, Vic. I'm sorry. So we're going to make an announcement that police will be at gas stations. So, I mean, we saw a video of the carjacking in front of the Sears Tower. Yes, I still call it the Sears Tower. So if you tell people where you're going to be, then they'll just continue their carjacking ways where you're not going to be. I mean, is it that complicated? Is that the only place people stop and get out of the car? Or can be stopped? Maybe you make it a little bit more complicated, but it doesn't seem to inhibit those who are insistent on this sort of criminal activity, does it? Doesn't seem to be. What are we up since year over year, 200%?
In carjacking, 283%.
All right.
One as young as 12, most about 40%. My cop's friend told me are between 15 and 18 years old.
Terry in Rogers Park.
I think these teachers want to keep this e-learning going because it's much, much easier on them. but they still get paid the same.
Yeah, they don't have to fight traffic. They don't have to dress up to go to school. They don't, you know, have to deal with kids in person. But I do know some teachers that do want to go back.
Of course.
Is a group of them that really wants to go back. And what was the vote, 70% to 30 last night?
No, ABC News reported 54%.
Oh, it was the delegates who voted 70% to go back.
Tony in Downers Grove.
Hey, Dan, I think this is kind of relevant, even though it's a little off the topic. There's a documentary on YouTube, a real-time documentary called Chicago at the Crossroads by Brad Chertoff. And what interests me is it tries to go back and talk about the root of housing and how it started. But it's about systemic – in the end, it's about systemic racism. And I watched it twice, and it's important because I think it's trying to drive home that we have to accept our white privilege, which was, I believe, part of what the documentary was getting at. And you have to understand it, and what are you going to do about it? And I think it's important because it coincides with what's going on currently, because at the end of the day, as we get back to the normal or the new normal, those areas that they're talking about are still going to be what they are. And no progress is going to be made. And the fingers are still going to be pointed at, well, accept what you've done to us and what are you going to do for us? And I think that's a dangerous path going down.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. Sure. By the way, Chicago, the most de facto segregated city in America, arguably, has been for a long time, will continue to be. 100 years of uninterrupted Democrat rule. 100 years of Democrat representation at the city council level in all of those neighborhoods that are majority-minority. So tell me again how, you know, white conservatives in the city, the few of us like me, are the problem. Tell me what I need to make amends for exactly, what I've done from a policy perspective that has created the Chicago that we view today. Oh, and by the way, in a related law enforcement story, John Lausch, the U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, he's sacked by Biden, you know, cleaning out all the U.S. attorneys. I remember when this was a big controversy, the president moving to install his own U.S. attorneys. When Trump did it, Preet Bharara in New York gets canned, and this is a national scandal. John Lausch, in the middle of possibly a prosecution of Mike Madigan, the longest-serving House Speaker in American history, state House Speaker in American history, he gets canned, and you hear nary a word on it locally. Wall Street Journal opined on it. Durbin and Duckworth sent a letter to Biden saying they opposed his termination to cover their asses. And then we just move on our merry way, and nothing changes.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Just rounding out our conversation from before Mike Scott's newscast about Operation Safe Pump. This is police officers being charged to pump gas for seniors to prevent carjackings.
Yeah, it's a safety issue, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We got some other suggestions on that. Why don't the police just offer to drive the carjackers wherever they want to go? Oh. That's an idea. Operation Safe Valet. Police officers as professional drivers for carjackers. Mm. That's an idea. That is an idea. Maybe somebody come up with an app specifically for carjackers. Also, a police officer friend texting, it's embarrassing. I remember a time where I felt very proud to put this uniform on. Now I call it a costume. And I responded to her, because they're forcing you to pantomime a police officer. And that's what's happening. So I don't know, maybe we'll need a U.S. Marshal. We'll have U.S. Marshals on planes. We'll have to have a Chicago police officer in every civilian car in order to prevent carjackings. Anything but Operation Prosecute Violent Offenders. That's the one operation.
That's the common sense one, yes.
That's the one operation the civilian political leaders in Chicago will not entertain. It's just remarkable. Also, this remarkable on a positive note, Jason Riley, Wall Street Journal columnist, ed board member, on schools. Data from a website that aggregates test score results finds 23 of the top 30 schools in New York in 2019 in terms of performance were charters. He writes, the feat is all the more impressive because those schools sported student bodies that were more than 80% Black and Hispanic, and some two-thirds of the kids qualified for free or discount lunches, meaning they qualified financially. The Empire State's results were reflected nationally. U.S. News and World Report ranking released for 2019, three of the top 10 public high schools in the country were charters, as were 23 of the top 100, even though charters make up only 10% of the nation's 24,000 public high schools. He also tackles some of the arguments made against charters by teachers' union apparatchiks that that students the charter schools succeed by handpicking the best students. Well, in point of fact, 43 states have charter schools. All but three mandate lotteries be used to choose students randomly. Not true. And also, if the poverty and segregation and systemic racism that is preventing Black and brown kids from succeeding in school, then how do you account for example, the performance of those charter schools that are majority minority and majority kids on free or reduced school lunch, meaning below the, they qualify in terms of their household finances. So, yeah, the arguments just continue to melt away. And to some extent, you say, well, when is it going to happen? And I guess this is sort of like the opposite of The Big Short, the crash. When is it going to happen? When's the housing bubble going to burst? And the famous line, it's happening. You just haven't felt it yet. And so the flip side of that is, when is it going to happen? School choice, the expansion of competition, the embrace of charter schools. It's happening. Maybe you haven't felt it yet. It's not where it should be. As I say, 10% of the nation's 24,000 public schools being charters. Not as many states have opportunity scholarship programs as should. They're not as expansive as they should be, but it's happening. It's happening. And the question that Riley posed in his piece is, has the teachers' union or the teachers' unions writ large nationwide, have they finally overplayed their hands in places like Chicago? For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by former Wisconsin governor and current president and CEO of Young America's Foundation, Scott Walker. Governor Walker, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning. Great to be with you. A little cold here in the Midwest, but we're hardy, so that's right.
Yeah, that's why we're used to that in February, I suppose.
Minus 19, it'll be fine.
So Milwaukee was sort of the ground zero for the school choice movement back in the early 90s, Polly Williams and Governor Tommy Thompson and that whole movement to introduce choice and give poor, largely minority families the same options as wealthier families around Milwaukee. And so Wisconsin's been a leader on that issue. And I just wonder what your answer to Jason Riley's question is. Have the teachers' unions finally overplayed their hand during this pandemic?
Absolutely. You see it nowhere greater than in Chicago, but we see it elsewhere as well. In New York, in Fairfax County, Virginia, across the nation, I was pleased to be a part of that in the 90s with Tommy Thompson. Actually, was part of the second wave early in the 90s that not only expanded vouchers to low-income families, starting the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program, but expanding it to include religious faith-based schools, which has been a huge boom for families. Now, not only in Milwaukee, but as governor, I pushed to expand it statewide, and it's been phenomenal. It puts power in the hands of the parents to make the right decision. I think in general, not just because of the teachers union, but at a time when people are wondering, parents are wondering, why can't my kids go back to school? Why are they being taught in some cases some of this nonsense they're seeing virtually? But particularly, why can't they go to school? It's a great time to say, well, instead of giving the government all the money for education, let's just give each parent a fixed amount, let he or she or that family go out and pick what's right for their child. In most cases, it's going to be in person, but in other instances, it might be virtual. But let them make that decision. That's exactly right. And the results, as you were just talking about, speak for themselves, not only in Wisconsin, but across the nation.
But this hybrid learning and remote learning and combination of both are neither in certain school districts, again, like you mentioned, and also in Philadelphia. This cannot be a sustainable system, but I'm already hearing talk of next fall that they want to do a hybrid system. They always want to give kids a chance to either do remote or in-person learning. And I think we need to get them back in the classroom, off computers. We need pen and paper and real interaction between the teacher and students.
Well, and this is where, as you know, you're probably in the same boat. I don't often agree with the political statements of the mayor of Chicago, but on this one, she's absolutely right. You know, in fact, if Chicago was in the state of Wisconsin, because of our Act 10 reforms that, of course, got all the attention and the hundreds of thousands of protesters in return for 14 of our Senate Democrats going down to Illinois 10 years ago. But our reforms have paid off, and for all the hype and hysteria, what they really did is take the power out of the union bosses' hands and put them firmly in the hands of the not only the taxpayers, but the people they elect to run their schools and local governments. And in Chicago, you could have gone back some time ago to full-time in-person school. I thought the mayor was exactly right when she pointed out not just that kids learn better, but particularly minority kids who are already in many cases at a disadvantage, not so much just because of their race, but their economic status. They really need in-person education and was very passionate about that. And I thought she was absolutely right. And yet the teachers' unions blocked that every step of the way. I thought what epitomized this more than anything, you've talked about it, was the teachers' union, one of the leaders who in one instance on social media said, this is absolutely outrageous. We can't be in person. And then later that day, we saw her on Instagram by a pool in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
You can't make this stuff up. And that's exactly why I think you're right. The union has overplayed their hand.
Yeah, although, Lightfoot's encouragement is about 10 months late. And basically, Chicago Democrats' encouragement with respect to the instruction in CPS is about, 60 years late and just continues to be lacking. But I wonder...
That shows you how outrageous it is that even someone who normally is politically out of tune as much as the mayor and some of the other leaders down, even they understand how really critical this is to get these kids back in the school, back in the classroom. There's a more than just a debate about the unions at stake. This is about these kids' futures.
Well, exactly. And I don't understand why this isn't more of a central issue for the Republican Party, that it's just relentlessly drum beating on this, particularly when you have divisions within Democrat ranks. And I'm not just talking about some mayors and some teachers unions. I'm talking about some mayors and some teachers unions and Joe Biden. Joe Biden saying, maybe we should try to get back to one day a week in-person learning as a sop to the unions. So that really, if you press on these mayors and frankly, suburbans, including in the suburbs and suburban school districts, the parents. And so is this the path you want to chart, that you have teachers unions aligned with your federal leadership, the people in control of the federal government, to say one day of in-person learning is enough to strike the balance between the interests of the teachers unions and the kids? This seems like a golden opportunity to advance the substance of the issue as well as the politics.
Well, and I think they need to even go further. I mean, remember a week ago, the CDC director, for all this hype over the last year about science and science deniers, who are the science deniers now? The CDC director got up at a White House press briefing on COVID-19 and said it is absolutely safe for students and staff to go back, even if the teachers haven't been fully vaccinated. It is safe to go back to the classroom. Within hours, the White House press secretary, Jen, I'll circle back to you, said, well, she was really speaking in her own personal capacity. She was listed as the CDC director at a White House press briefing on COVID. And yet, because it was the blowback they got from the teachers union, I said, you're not an essential worker if you can't show up when it's essential. And in America, the teachers unions or any union should be calling the shots. It should ultimately be the American people and people in each state and in each jurisdiction. And that's what's just so frustrating here is the science overwhelmingly says that kids and staff are safe. And in fact, in Chicago, the Catholic schools have been back in school since last fall. That's been true in New York and elsewhere across the country. You can do this. You can follow safe protocols. You can do things that keep your staff safe. They've overwhelmed. I was just with someone last night who's with a Catholic school in Milwaukee. And she said the only people on their staff they had troubles were people who got COVID, not through school, but through interacting with other people. outside of school where they weren't following the protocols. So if you follow the protocols, there's no reason why kids and staff can't be safe at school. And it's time for us to stand up for the kids.
I want to get to your tenure at Young America's Foundation, what that's going to look like, the fights you're going to take up in an environment where the names of Lincoln and Washington are being removed from schools. And even it just in Western civilization generally, Churchill and J.K. Rowling's names are also being removed from schools across the pond. How Young America's Foundation is going to battle against the effort to rewrite American history?
Yeah, it's insane. San Francisco took 44 names off, including Paul Revere. What did Paul Revere do to get the disdain of the woke left? It is absolutely crazy out there. I saw last night the Dallas Mavericks now are no longer going to play the national anthem. It used to be the American flag and the national anthem were those civic rituals that brought everyone together. It didn't matter your race, your sex, your ethnic background, even your political party. You know, when they played the national anthem, every American stood. We stood when the flag went by. Those were things that were passed on from one generation to the next, and they united us as a country. And Ronald Reagan warned about this back in 1989, his farewell address. Reagan was a longtime supporter of YAF, YAF.org, if people are interested, Young America's Foundation. And he warned us that if we weren't vigilant towards passing on that love for America, that pride in our country, it was going to pass. And sadly, he was right. And that's where our goal is. We do well with the students we reach. I just want to reach more. When I see these numbers embracing socialism, we're going to have a presence on every campus, more than 4,000 in America. We're going to delve even deeper into high school. We're going to start a junior high program. We've got the Reagan Ranch, which is pretty cool, Reagan's actual ranch out in Santa Barbara, California, where we have conferences. I'm going today to Dixon, Illinois, where we just took over the boyhood home of President Reagan, another place we're going to bring in speakers and conferences. And we're going to take our YouTube, in fact, if people want to join us, YouTube.com/YAFTV. Tomorrow night at 7 Central, we're going to be talking about how the reforms that saved Wisconsin 10 years ago can help save America. So there's a lot of different ways. Big speakers on campus like Ben Shapiro and Michael Knowles, we're going to do even more of that future. But there's just so much to be done. And what we find is if young people hear the truth works. Conservative, common sense thought works. We just know that they're trying to cancel it on campus and culture. And even with big tech and our communications, we cannot let that happen.
I leaned on Young America's Foundation many, many years ago when I was an undergrad at Northwestern to bring in speakers on campus to expand the debate there. It's a great organization. Ron Robinson, before you, did a great job, and glad that you're at the helm. Scott Walker, former Wisconsin governor, president, CEO of Young America's Foundation. Thanks, Scott.
Have a great one. Be warm.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. House impeachment manager, Democrat Congressman Jamie Raskin, made the case for the Democrats yesterday in day one of impeachment 2.0. And it was largely sentimentality and an emotional appeal, for example.
And when they were finally rescued over an hour later by Capitol officers and we were together, I hugged them. And I apologized, and I told my daughter, Tabitha, who's 24 and a brilliant algebra teacher in Teach for America. Now, I told her how sorry I was, and I promised her that it would not be like this again the next time she came back to the Capitol with me. And you know what she said? She said, "Dad, I don't want to come back to the Capitol."
Oh,
of all the terrible, brutal things I saw and I heard on that day, and since then, that one hit me the hardest.
Mm-hmm. Well, call me heartless, but I find, and I'm sorry that the Raskin family has recently suffered the loss of a child, but that doesn't excuse that sort of sophistry. And it shouldn't put Republicans on their heels. But unfortunately, President Trump's defense team apparently was not prepared for the Democrats' stock and trade when it comes to these matters. So here was Bruce Castor, who was first up on the violence on the Capitol, at the Capitol on January 6th.
Before I begin, I want to comment on the outstanding presentation from our opponents and the emotion that certainly welled up in Congressman Raskin about his family being here during that terrible day. And you will not hear any member of the team representing former President Trump say anything but in the strongest possible way denounce the violence of the rioters and those that breached the Capitol, the very citadel of our democracy, literally the symbol that flashes on television whenever you're trying to explain that we're talking about the United States. Instant symbol. To have it attacked is repugnant in every sense of the word. The loss of life is horrific.
Mm-hmm. That was an insufficient response. In fact, it was an ineffectual response as far as I'm concerned. That cedes the moral authority to Jamie Raskin and House Democrat Socialists that they do not occupy. There is no opposing party on the matter of what happened on January 6th or political violence generally. I mean, maybe there are some people on the margins, but they're not part of the legitimate discussion. So you have to compliment Jamie Raskin for his histrionics while trying to Me Too him like you're a guilty party or you represent a guilty party. And it's not just Trump's legal team you're representing, which is something that was completely lost on Castor and Schoen. You're representing 74 million Trump voters in pertinent part because the left is pursuing the impeachment of 74 million voters, as far as I'm concerned. And so Castor, you know, offering obsequiousness on top of obsequiousness, then, you know, 10 minutes in, 8 minutes into his 45-minute statement, he goes off on this seven-minute hagiography of former United States senators as well as current ones.
Senators of the United States, they're not ordinary people. They're extraordinary people in the technical sense, extraordinary people.
Uh-huh. And recalling how he and his parents listened to Everett Dirksen's speeches on their record player back in the day, and all these senators today are patriots.
The senators really are different. And I have been around United States senators before. Two of them in this room from Pennsylvania, I like to think, are friendly toward me, or at least friends of mine when we're not politically adverse.
Yeah, and he recalled how he was so wowed by the speeches from great men like Bob Dole and Bob Byrd. Good Lord. Alan Dershowitz was on Newsmax in real time commenting on what he was seeing from Bruce Castor.
There is no argument. I have no idea what he's doing. I have no idea why he's saying what he's saying. You know, he's introducing himself. I'm a nice guy. I like my senators. I know my senators. Senators are great people. Come on. The American people are entitled to an argument, a constitutional argument. I suspect it will be forthcoming from David Schoen. But this, just after all kinds of very strong presentations on the part of the House managers with the videotapes and the emotional speech by Congressman Raskin, my former student, you get up there and you respond. We know that hard cases make bad law. I probably would have started with that. This is a hard.
And at least per what Dershowitz expected, David Schoen did deliver. He did make a substantive, if only workmanlike case that the sort of norms of due process were violated by the House.
The denial of due process in this case, of course, starts with the House of Representatives. In this unprecedented snap impeachment process, the House of Representatives denied every attribute of fundamental constitutional due process that Americans correctly have come to believe is part of what makes this country so great. How and why did that happen? It is a function of the insatiable lust for impeachment in the House for the past 4 years.
And there was a video attendant to that with Democrats calling for impeaching President Trump for everything under the sun 20 minutes into his administration, you know, starting with jaywalking across Pennsylvania Avenue. So I thought that was perhaps the best moment of the presentation on the defense, but there weren't a lot of great ones. The combined presentation of Trump's defense attorneys had the effect of moving Republican Senator Bill Cassidy over to the Pat Toomey, Ben Sasse, Mitt Romney camp of voting with Democrats to move this forward, saying the Senate does have jurisdiction to try a president once he's out of office. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Andy McCarthy again. He's a former chief assistant U.S. attorney in Manhattan, contributing editor at National Review and author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I know we don't come to the same conclusion about impeachment in this matter, but I wonder what your assessment was of both the presentations by specifically Representative Raskin and then Trump's defense team.
Well, you know, I think, Dan, the first thing that you have to keep reminding yourself, and I'm not just talking to you, I talk to me, you know, every time I have to talk about this. It's political. It's not legal.
Yeah.
So, for example, I thought the House presentation was very effective. The playing the video, I thought, was a very smart thing to do. If you remember the last impeachment, it kind of opened with a bunch of dry, abstruse legal argument about what a high crime and misdemeanor was. And I think what they found when they looked at the television ratings was they lost most of the country after the first, maybe even the first couple of hours, but, you know, certainly the first day. And I've always thought as a trial lawyer and a prosecutor for a long time, the big advantage you have in a trial is you get to go first. And, you know, there's only one moment in a trial before everybody realizes that it's not all that exciting, that it's, you know, there's boring parts and technical parts and droning parts. There's one moment when you have everybody's rapt attention, and you either capitalize on it and you grab them or you don't. So that's the moment to play that video. And they, you know, even though it was not supposed to be that, it was supposed to be an argument about constitutionality, they understood that this is a political production, not a normal trial, and they grabbed their audience when they had that moment. So it was the right approach for them. And you have to understand that if this was a normal trial, Jamie Raskin would not be the prosecutor, right? Because he's a witness to the proceeding. His most effective rendering, his most effective speechifying to the chamber was his very personal story about, you know, being under his own personal experience and his family's experience of being under siege and their reaction to that. That was all very gripping and dramatic and effective. It would have no place in a normal trial, because if a lawyer is a witness, if he's an actor on the stage of the facts that are going to be played out in the trial, he's not allowed to be a lawyer in the case, because that's unsworn testimony then. So, you know, none of this is a trial. I said, you know, Fox asked me to do something to, write something to tell people kind of the nuts and bolts of what they were going to see. And what I was moved to write was that if your idea of due process is the Anglo-American tradition centuries old that you see day in and day out in courts all across the United States, where thousands of trials take place every day, and then you wandered into the Senate on Tuesday, you'd be forgiven for saying, you know, Toto, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore. Because it's not, you know, it's not a trial. You have to call it a trial because it's called a trial in the Constitution. But a Senate trial is simply not a judicial trial. And the norms of due process go out the window. And what you have to keep telling yourself is Trump is going to win in the end anyway.
I know.
You know,
but is this going to...
The outcome is done.
It ruined his reputation on the way. And also, I mean, I felt like I was watching a criminal trial. They were talking about seven people died when in actuality, you know, two died on the Capitol, three died from medical conditions, and two died days later because of suicide, which I don't know how they could tie that in. But did you feel like you were watching a criminal trial?
Well, no, because I've been in a lot of criminal trials, so, you know, this doesn't look like one. But it's not. It's a political presentation. And, you know, I can understand why people who support the president would be upset by it, because, you know, part of the due process violation here is they really didn't. I mean, some of this is Trump's fault for firing, you know, he fires every lawyer he has and he burns bridges with everyone in short order. But, you know, usually in a trial, they would give you one chance to change your lawyers and give them adequate time to prepare. It seemed to me it was pretty obvious yesterday that they didn't have very much time to prepare. And I must say, there have been times that in a courtroom that I've been surprised by something effective that my adversary did. The last thing you do is say that out loud. You know, you go back
no,
to
no
your
kidding.
Office and you tell your attorney, you know.
Well, so this is what I'm saying. So that's, you know, they didn't have a lot of time to prepare. You know, there are basics. You don't need any time to prepare. And point of fact, oh, since we've been talking about this for weeks, all the arguments are in the public arena. They could cut and paste former appellate court judge Michael Luttig's Twitter thread on the constitutionality or lack thereof of the Senate impeaching a president out of office if they wanted to, you know, lodge their pro forma response on that topic. You know, Schoen, as I said, gave fine. He made a statement about due process norms, which was appropriate. And there was some effort by Castor to raise the issue of First Amendment protections and right. so forth. But I mean, it was just such a all they have to do is just kind of give the gentleman's see arguments on the topics at bar and sit down and call the question. And they didn't do that yesterday.
Well, but you want them to be as effective as the other side. You know, yes, all those things are available and any competent lawyer can go in and argue. You know, you'd need about a day to master all of the things that have been written and then go in and argue the case on constitutionality. But at the same time, you could tell that Raskin and Ciccolini and Ragus, they've been living with this case for a couple of months. And it showed, you know, you may be right that all of this stuff is the kind of information that a competent lawyer ought to be able to master in short order. But I think there was a pretty obvious difference yesterday between people who've been living with this case for a long time and people who look like they've been living with it for 5 minutes. So.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I suppose that there's something to that. I don't know. I just you have to, it seems to me, be oblivious to what's been going on and the discussions that have been going on in every quarter in this country about these various topics that are addressed by both sides to offer such a disjointed milquetoast effort as was offered, particularly by Castor. I mean, I don't know. Beating on him too hard. But geez.
Look, I think, number one, it, in the long run, it doesn't make any difference because it's political. It's not legal. So the effectiveness of the lawyers is not going to make a big difference to the outcome. But I have to say, I almost fell out of my chair when Castor made the argument that, you know, there's no point in disqualifying Trump because the American people know how to do this. We just had an election right. and they booted him out of office when the whole reason we're at this point is that Trump claims that the election was stolen. So you have, like, the president out there saying the election's illegitimate, and you have his lawyer in the impeachment trial saying there's no reason to disqualify this guy because the American people can handle it. We just had a legitimate election where they booted him out.
Well,
so
yeah,
there's, what are we doing here?
Yeah, well, right. So there's that aspect to it, and then there's the other aspect, and I think this is when Cruz leaned over and said, is he talking about what, you know, what's at bar right now, which is, you know, whether we have jurisdiction, and Cassidy's like, not yet, was the idea that because you had an election where the target of the impeachment lost, that means that the argument about whether the Senate has jurisdiction is moot, and one has nothing to do with the other, and you have too many lawyers in the Senate that know better.
Yeah, I think that's right, although I keep going back to the same point, which is that we're treating this like it's a legal question.
I know.
And I just don't think it is. I think it's a political question. And I must say, in the last week or so, I've looked at a lot of the old impeachment stuff. And what I'm struck by is the first impeachment in the United States was in 1797, the impeachment of Senator Blount. And the House impeached him, even though he was resigning. And the Senate ended up taking trial and dismissing the case before having a trial on grounds which are dubious because they didn't make a good record. So you don't know whether they dismissed it because they didn't have jurisdiction because he wasn't a senator anymore. Or interestingly, if they dismissed it because as a senator, he wasn't a civil officer of the United States, that they made that conclusion. But I just think for all my friends who are making these textual arguments that, you know, the framers clearly meant this and the framers clearly meant that, the House of Representatives, 8 years after we began constitutional governance, impeached a senator. And if it was so clear that, like, a senator was not impeachable, the House wouldn't have impeached him. And these were guys who were acting within the fresh, not only were they acting within the fresh living memory of the Constitution, many members of Congress had been at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. You know, the very people who were involved in crafting the Constitution didn't think this was all so clear with respect to impeachment. And I just think that they just didn't give a lot of thought to this.
Well, it's also like church. You know, many attend, few understand. Perhaps. Yes.
Well, I think the guys who attended the Constitution understood. But
yeah,
whatever.
Fair enough. All right, Andy McCarthy, former Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney, Manhattan, contributing editor, National Review, author of the bestseller "Ball of Collusion: The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency." Andy, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too. And he joined us on our Turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and a good piece by Lee Smith, the investigative reporter. He does a lot of work for RealClearInvestigations.com and other outlets. This one in Tablet, the 30 tyrants. And he lays out in painstaking detail the connections between what have now become American oligarchs and Chinese communists. He was on Tucker Carlson the other night to talk about his piece. And here's what he said about those who exercise outsized control of our government, our culture, our lives in America.
Yeah, I mean, basically what I wanted to explain is I wanted to explain why so many things look crazy. Many things, for instance, that you cover on your show all the time. For instance, tonight, why people are coming across the border in such profound numbers. It all looks crazy until you realize there's a reason it's going on. And the reason is because the oligarchy that runs this country now is not primarily loyal to the United States. They do not care about the amount of damage they do to America. They don't care about the amount of damage they do to Americans. That's part of the system. Their primary loyalty is to their relationship to the Communist Chinese Party. That is their center of gravity. It's the source of their wealth, privilege, and prestige.
That's sort of an astounding statement, isn't it? That the oligarchs, those household names that run multi-billion-dollar, in some cases trillion-dollar companies, their main loyalty is to Chinese communists. But Lee Smith provided a little bit of a taste, and you can get more of it if you read that piece and his piece in the Tablet, which I'll tweet out. He provided some of the details to buttress his case.
They looked at an enormous, cheap labor pool, and they said, we're going to get rich. And that's precisely what happened. We are more than a quarter of a century along, and that's precisely what's happened. Now, one of the interesting things that happened during the Donald Trump presidency, because Donald Trump started calling these people out, I think that Donald Trump didn't even have that clear a sense of how tied in, how extensive this network was. One of the examples I mentioned is, for instance, whoever would have put Apple CEO Tim Cook and LeBron James in the same family album? But there they are, sure enough, because they both rely, their wealth relies on the two same things, cheap Chinese labor and a growing Chinese consumer market. And if you look across, this is not just, it's not just entertainment, it's not just tech. It goes into the corporate worlds. It goes into finance. Unfortunately, it affects our government throughout. One of the most astonishing revelations was a memo that former DNI John Ratcliffe wrote regarding the CIA, regarding their intelligence analysis. CIA management was apparently bullying analysts, saying they didn't like their analysis of China because they were worried about the policies it might encourage, meaning Donald Trump's policies, who was hard on China. Therefore, CIA management was protecting China from solid analysis. It's astonishing. But take it one step further. Remember who owns the cloud on which all of the CIA's information is collected, and that's Jeff Bezos, who is China's number one distributor in the United States.
Is it any wonder why in 2020, 57% of Republicans say they were satisfied with big business? This year, according to Gallup's annual survey, 31%. Part of that's the culture war coming from the C-suites. Part of that is sort of an intuitive understanding, I think, of what Lee Smith is talking about without having all the details put together that he has put together. And the basis for more details, hopefully, to be put together. For a discussion on this topic, as well as COVIDnomics, we're pleased to be joined again by Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Amy.
What about what Lee Smith outlined there?
Well, I would say a couple things. First of all, I think that China certainly has huge impact on what corporate America is doing. And it's not necessarily inappropriate. Like, this is a giant consumer market with 1.1, 1.2 billion people. As they become a middle-class country, we obviously want to sell our stuff to them. And so it makes sense that companies want to get into that market. I had dinner last night with some business folks, and they're not huge business, but they're trying to get their hooks into China because it is a big consumer market. So, look, I don't have a problem with that kind of activity. What worries me is that we are in a race for economic supremacy with China. There's no question about it. China does want to take over as the economic superpower. They've made it very clear they have a plan to do that by 2025 to 2030. And the race is on, folks, and we better start taking competitiveness seriously. And we're not doing that. I mean, Joe Biden is everything he has done so far as president. He's only been, it seems like 2 years, but it's only been a few weeks, has been basically to put America last, not America first. And we're not building pipelines. We're not drilling on federal lands where we have trillions of dollars of assets. We are putting more and more regulations on. We're re-entering the Paris Climate Accord, which is, China is laughing at us for that. They don't have to change their behavior, and all the costs are imposed on us. And by the way, the other thing is he wants to massively increase tax rates on American companies, small businesses, and our corporations, which is going to lead to more business in China, not less. So that's my problem, is we better take this seriously, or we're going to end up like, the Kansas City Chiefs against the Buccaneers,
right,
on Sunday night.
Why can't President Biden be, remember the Prime Minister of Japan when he paid companies, Japanese companies, to move out of China and come back to the homeland? Why wouldn't he follow that lead?
Well, it's a great point. Look, we don't have to pay them to come back. We just have to incentivize them not to leave. Right? Right. I mean, if you're going to rate, we got our business tax rate down to 21% from, we were at 35, 36%. And we did that not because we love American companies, but we wanted to incentivize them to be here in Illinois, in Michigan, in New York, in California, in Texas, in Florida, not in Beijing and Shanghai and Mexico City and so on. And it worked, by the way. It worked, folks. We brought $1 trillion of capital back to the United States. We have factories moving back to the United States because we made America a more hospitable place to do business. And my point is, Biden isn't doing that. You know, he thinks we should pay all the bills for the rest of the world. And he thinks we should raise our tax rates and we should have a $1.9 trillion of more spending. By the way, where are we going to get that $1.9 trillion from, Dan Laney?
We're going to print
it. Who's going to buy the bonds? China.
That too. But here's the thing,
we're going to be more indebted to them.
Yeah, but here's something else, though, too, I want to get your reaction to. I mean, it seems to me that the Biden administration is just pursuing the same approach towards the economy that the Chinese communists do, a command-control, you know, quasi-capitalist economy where the point is to get through transfer payments or funny money people to a certain comfort level where you can run roughshod over them. They don't care about their liberties so much, their opportunities, so long as they have a certain comfort level. The kicker, of course, is that the Chinese communists are not bounded by concerns about the well-being of their constituents or silliness like the Paris Accords. They don't have to deal with young socialists on college campuses and in corporate boardrooms that are virtue signaling. They don't have our politics, so they just plow over people, literally, in some cases, where we're sort of now have the best worlds, the worst of both worlds, I should say. We have the cultural Marxists that are being catered to, and we have the Chinese communist economic model that's being pursued by the administration.
So, first of all, I do not think that China is going to take over the world because the central planning model that you just described, Dan, quite accurately, doesn't work. And we know it's going to crash and burn because when you have politicians, whether they're politicians in Washington, D.C., or politicians in Beijing making the decisions, it crashes and burns. I mean, that's the single most important economic lesson of history. It's never worked anywhere, anytime, and we're going to try it again in the United States. And, you know, what frustrates me, Dan, you know, for example, I've been doing a lot of work, as you guys know, in the energy industry. And the arrogance of these, you know, people like Jen Psaki and Biden and John Kerry, and they go into these places like in West Virginia and say, oh, we're going to close down all the coal mines, and then they go into the oil patch in Texas. Oh, sorry, you're not going to make oil and gas anymore. But you know what, folks? They're going to make solar panels. You know, people are like, what the hell are they talking about? And by the way, do you know what the solar – there was a great study that just came out. We've had these programs for like 15 years to help the coal miners whose jobs we killed because we can't use coal. You know what these guys make now? $14 an hour.
Oh, boy.
Making $60,000, $70,000 a year, and now they're making $14 a year. Gee, thank you, Joe Biden. I want to be a solar panel installer.
My question is, crashing the economy a bug or a feature? My point is to say whether it's mandates for COVID tests that would crater the airlines, or whether it is the energy policy, or whether it is just Joe Biden poor-mouthing the economy. James Freeman, your colleague at Wall Street Journal, had a good piece about this. Why is Joe Biden talking about a dark winter when the Labor Department reported 6.6 million job openings in December? Yeah. There's a reason he's poor-mouthing the economy, is because that's of the course. Way you get to spend, you get to print and spend $2 trillion in funny money and continue to consolidate all things at the federal level.
Yeah, I've only been saying that for 4 months. Yeah, well, of course, that's exactly what they're doing. They, you know, we have an economy that's on the mend. We don't need $1.1 trillion. We don't need $1.5 trillion. We don't need $1.9 trillion, folks. We need zero. I mean, if Milton Friedman were alive today, he'd say we should be cutting government spending and getting rid of the barriers and burdens of government. And yet, you're exactly right. This is precisely their strategy. They're coming in and they're saying, oh, my God, it's the greatest crisis in the history of the United States. We've got to spend $1.9 trillion. We've got to do it immediately, right now. So don't wait one more minute. Spend this $1.9 trillion. And by the way, there's $1 trillion they haven't even already spent. That's how insane this is, folks. These people are out of control. $1 trillion that we just passed, a month ago, hasn't even been spent yet. And they want to spend another $1.9 trillion. By the way, the allocations just came out last night. You know, you may not have a chance to look at the numbers, but I think it's like $20 billion for I'll have to look this up, but it's billions and billions of dollars to Illinois. So I know you'll sleep well. Here it is. I've got it right here.
Okay.
How much does Illinois get? they got, here it is. Yeah, you know, something like $10 billion. So, you know, gee, well, how can you turn that down? Of course, you know, the federal government can only give money to states if it does take state money from other states.
Okay, so then it's a feature, not a bug. This is purposeful. It's purposeful to a particular end. It's not purposeful because they think this is going to be good policy. It's purposeful because they think this is going to enhance their ability to exercise control.
Yeah,
and so,
of course,
we're not. But then you're, at the same time, you're conceding that you're saying, well, China is not going to overtake us because our central planners are better than their central planners.
What I'm saying is we're still not as big centers as they are. I mean, they do have real central planning. Yeah, we are moving in that direction. There's no question
Republicans are, especially those Republicans celebrated by the press for being anti-Trump, like Mitt Romney, are moving in that direction, too. Romney introduced the Family Security Act last week, which would provide payments for children, $350 a month for every child a family raising under the age of 5, $250 for every child between the age of 6 and 17, up to $1,250 a month. In addition to these benefits, new parents would collect a $1,400 one-time payment just before their child's birth. In sum, the parents of a child born next year could receive up to $62,000 in child support from Uncle Sam by the time the kid turns 18, if Romney's bill became law. And why wouldn't it be with this Congress and this president?
So, by the way, I just got the correct number, so I want to be exactly accurate. Illinois will get, you ready for this, guys? Ready to party? $13.2 billion.
Yeah, 10, 13 billion. It's a few billion here. It doesn't mean anything.
Congratulations, you won the lottery, folks. And so you get $13.2 billion. And by the way, you know, California gets $40 billion. So, gee, it's all going to the blue states. What a shock. I'm sorry, what was your question?
Mitt Romney and his Family Security Act,
oh,
$62,000 for a child born next year in lifetime benefits.
We're just passing out free money, folks. I mean, you know, this is – I'm doing these estimates with Casey Mullen. We're estimating that the person for not working with the family credits, with the, $1,400 additional payments, with the unemployment benefits, with the increased food stamps, with the expanded Medicaid, you know, you can make about $60,000 a year this year, folks, for not working. Why is anybody working? Well, Dan, maybe why do you get up early in the morning and do that job? You can make $60,000 for doing nothing.
Yeah, for the love of the game.
This is a serious point. Most of us do love our jobs. We want to be productive. We want to be, you know, feel like we have a mission in life. But there are a lot of people who don't. And a lot of people have really tough jobs. You know, we have jobs we love. But if you're a truck driver or, you're a construction worker, those are tough jobs. And we're going to pay people more money for not working than the people who are delivering things, the construction workers, the people working in nursing homes. Folks, that's not fair. It's not smart. And it's going to hurt our economy. We're going to have 40 million unemployed people, and we're going to have 8 million open jobs.
Yeah, and many of those unemployed people will be unemployed and loving it, and that's the real long-term problem. He is Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Okay, guys. Have a great week.
Thanks. You too, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Current Delta CEO Ed Bastian was allowed to come on CNN because Delta is the only airline that's still keeping the middle seat open.
Yes. They're going to for months to come. That was a big announcement.
Yeah, they don't care about profits, so they were allowed to come on CNN, which ironically does care about profits. Just ask Jeffrey Zucker. Mr. Bastian was asked by the fungible numbskull at the desk at CNN whether or not he would be supportive of what is being bandied about by Mayor Pete, the new transportation secretary, and others in the Biden administration requiring a negative COVID test in order to fly domestically. And here's what Ed Bastian had to say.
I think it'd be a horrible idea for a lot of reasons. First and foremost, we're carrying as a U.S. industry over a million people a day on average. And that number is starting to grow again, which we'd like to see. Travel domestically in the air transportation system is the safest form of transportation. I think we all know that. Incidence of spread aboard any of our planes is absolutely minimal. In fact, very, very few documented cases globally, not just domestically. And it would also take probably about 10% of the testing resources that this country needs to do to test sick people away from those people. It's hard to get tests. There's days of delay still. I think it would be a logistical nightmare and would set the transportation and travel industry back, but the whole hospitality sector, the hotels. It set us back at least probably another year in the recovery. It will not keep domestic flyers safer. If anything, it's going to keep people away from what they need to do, which is in terms of starting to get back out, for not just essential travel, but people need to start reclaiming their lives and taking testing resources away from those truly in need, I think would be a terrible decision.
Oh, I like the angle there, taking testing resources from those truly in need.
I don't know. I don't even know what Ed Bastian is talking about. Since when does the science, since when does the highest best use of scarce resources, since when does anything resembling a conversation about balancing security for people's individual freedom, when does that have anything to do with talking about COVID policy? I mean, especially on CNN. Everything that Ed Bastian said has no quarter on CNN or MSNBC or in the halls of power of big blue states and big blue cities, does it? And, oh, by the way, including the big blue territory of the District of Columbia these days. Am I wrong? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by Alex Berenson, former New York Times reporter, author of the number one bestseller, Unreported Truths About COVID-19 and Lockdowns. There's a combined parts 1 through 3, death counts, lockdowns, and masks. But now I'm afraid Alex Berenson may be giving up on us because his new book, he's going back to writing spy novels, The Power Couple, a novel, is his book, released February 9th. So you want to check that out, too. He's not just one trick pony. Alex Berenson, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And don't tell me you're going back to spy novels to the exclusion of continuing your work on COVID.
No. And in fact, I was talking to Amy about just off the air just a minute ago. So I wrote this book in 2018 and 2019. It's basically set in 2019, set in the pre-COVID world. And it's not really a political book. My novels in general are not political. I mean, they're set in the world of espionage, so there's going to be some political backdrop, but they're not political. And this one really is not political. It's really about this husband and wife, and they're in Barcelona with their kids for their 20th wedding anniversary, and their daughter goes missing, and they have to figure out what's going on. It turns out to be really about the marriage and the secrets in the marriage. So you can see that's not a political book. It's nothing to do with COVID.
Has Liam Neeson been cast for the male character yet?
There is a bit of a Taken meets Gone Girl vibe in here. I'm not gonna lie. Look, I've written. This is my 13th novel. My previous novels were all bestsellers. They all got review attention. I'm not saying they all got great reviews, but people reviewed them. They were taken seriously. This book has essentially been ignored by the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Associated Press, USA Today, all the places that normally at least, consider taking a look at my work have ignored it. And I can only presume, to think this way, that this has something to do with the fact that I've challenged the narrative on COVID, novel is being punished for this.
Well, you're talking nonsense about COVID like Ed Bastian. I mean, we can't be listening to people like you reading your work.
I mean, it's a really sort of insidious. Until you see cancel culture, and I don't know if this is cancel, this may be more of the ignore culture. I don't know how to describe it from the inside. It's insidious because this is me being punished in a way that has nothing to do with COVID. You can disagree with me about COVID if you like, and it's just the media sort of using its power to push back on somebody or to hurt somebody who doesn't follow the narrative. And I think it's, look, I'm not saying I know this. No one has come out to me and said this, although, of course, they would not. But it is, it's hard for me to see another explanation.
Well, considering what happened to Senator Hawley, are you surprised that Simon & Schuster even published your book?
Well, they had agreed a long time ago to publish it. And this is not about Simon & Schuster. They've supported the book. This is really about, you know, about all the places that should should at least consider reviewing it. Also, here's the other thing. This is sort of an interesting story about me at this point, right? I wrote this novel. I'll mention the name again, The Power Couple. And it came, it's out now. And meanwhile, I've become this person on COVID. But the only people who are interested in talking to me are, people in the conservative media. So it is what it is, and I'm just going to push on, and let's talk COVID.
Well, let's talk about COVID. Let's go back to what Ed Bastian over at Delta had to say about things. Gosh, he's invoking things I didn't think mattered, as I said at the outset, like transmission rates on domestic flights, like balancing scarce resources when it comes to testing, like trying to balance safety with people living their lives. Those are the sorts of metrics that are only given quarter in conservative talk arenas too, not usually on CNN. It's amazing.
And so, the idea that you would force people taking domestic flights to get a COVID test is a joke. Okay, where is the evidence that airplanes are a major vector for the transmission of COVID? Where have we seen? Have we seen one report of a domestic flight leading to an outbreak? No, we have not. That's A. B is, this thing is everywhere, okay? It's in every one of the 50 United States. It's all over the place. So what are we trying to prevent here? People who are likely asymptomatic from getting on a plane? I mean, if you're feeling lousy, don't get on the plane, and we already know that. But what are we trying to do here aside from destroy the domestic aviation industry? And I'll say one more thing.
Yeah.
Flying is so much safer than driving that if this pushes people to drive instead of fly, it will kill people.
Yeah, that's good a good point, too. And some response to this has been, well, then if we get the negative COVID test, then we don't have to wear a mask on the flight. Not so fast.
Right.
No. Didn't you not hear Jen Psaki say that even after you get vaccinated, you have to wear a mask and social distance? Tony Fauci is giving us some hope that maybe if everything goes right, according to him, and there's no scintilla of COVID-19 in the Western world, maybe we can relax the mask mandates. Maybe you can go down from three or two masks to one mask by the fall.
Do any of these people, are any of them looking at the data, not in the last year, even in the last month? Is anybody aware that right now the hospitals are emptying out of COVID patients in the United States, and then positive tests are down, I think, almost two-thirds since the beginning of January? I mean, it certainly looks like this wave of the epidemic is over, and whether or not we'll see another one, I don't know, but you can make a plausible case that half the country now has been infected from and recovered from COVID. Forget vaccines. I'm just talking about people who recovered naturally from COVID, because we know that 26 million number is a huge understatement.
Whether
it's a factor of four or a factor of eight, it's a huge understatement.
Because I heard a podcast with a CEO of Pfizer saying, if we factored in COVID positive antibody tests, we're looking at an additional 60 million Americans who've had COVID. That some of them didn't even know that they had it, and that combined with the 26 million, I mean, those are pretty high numbers.
That would be 85 million. That number is low. Okay, I guarantee you that number is low. And for whatever reason, in this country, we never set up a randomized ongoing antibody project, which would have told us exactly how many people really got this. And that's another, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, okay, but why don't we know how many people have really gotten this and recovered from it? Is it because it would tell us that we're much further along to the end of this than, the people who would love panic to go on forever will admit? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but I know that we've never done a proper randomized antibody study.
And they want panic to go on forever because, I don't know if it sells with advertising, with local news or the national news, but now it's all, we have to watch out for the UK variant. And they all say, we don't know if it's more deadly, but it might be more contagious. Always might, possibly, instead of some solid facts.
Right. That's right. And by the way, the UK, the trend in the UK is exactly the same as here. They peaked a month ago, and cases are plunging in the UK. Hospitalizations are plunging in the UK. So the UK variant is so dangerous that the UK is having exactly the same experience as the US right now.
Well, I don't know. I just can't get over Tom Brady not wearing a mask going into the stadium in Tampa for Super Bowl. It was such an opportunity for him to lead by example, and he didn't do it. In addition to his dad not wearing a mask when he came down on the field to congratulate his son on his seventh Super Bowl title. I mean, that's the real issue when it comes to COVID is our heroes not providing a better example along the lines of our heroes in the public health space and the Twitter sphere and Dorsey world, you know, our real heroes, those that are promoting and minding other people with respect to mask wearing and the like.
Yeah, our heroes like the, you know, like the next Surgeon General of the United States, assuming he's approved, who took more than $1 million last year to consult and speak about COVID.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, this is big business, and don't forget it. And the people who are making a lot of money off of it don't want it to go away. I mean, I hate to be that cynical about it, but there's certainly when you hear them talk about it, they don't want it to go away. And they want to beat up on people like me and you who stand up and say, we need to return to normalcy here.
I'll
say one last thing. Sorry, yeah. Go on.
No, well, I just want to go back to get your comment on Jen Psaki specifically. The idea that you're vaccinated, you still need to wear a mask, you still need to social distance. How is someone to read that other than this will go on in perpetuity?
That's right. And if you've already had it, you need to be vaccinated and you need to wear a mask and you need to social distance. When did the human immune system stop functioning? I missed that. Was that in March 2020? Was that in May 2020? Was that when Vivek Murthy got his $400,000 from Carnival Cruise Lines to consult? I don't know. I don't know when that happened. But one thing about the power couple, I have to say this. I was going back and reading it because I know the book's coming out. I know there's these interviews. We have to get back to life before COVID. We have to get back to a life where you can get on a plane and go somewhere and not have to worry about it, whether it's in Europe or the U.S. We have to get back to open bars and college kids behaving like college kids and normalcy. There are people who are going to get sick and die from this. We know that. This cannot be allowed to destroy society, and that seems to be where we're going.
But people are brainwashed. I mean, somebody here at this company I just talked to, like, did you hear we had 3 cases of COVID at our school? So what, 3 people have a cold? I mean, we have to test to see if we have a deadly disease. Are we shutting it all down? Everybody's scared.
The remarkable thing to me, Alex, too, I mean, just flying off that, is it's inversely proportional to good news. The better the news is, the more hysterical the make-believers, the lockdowners get, whether it's the J&J vaccine coming online as you were describing earlier, the drop in the number of infections, both in the UK and the US. As soon as we're making any sort of progress towards a compelling case or a more compelling case to more quickly reopen society, that's when you really get the hysterics and the virtue signaling and the virtue shaming and the, you know, we're going to be in this for a long while yet, so just hunker down.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And, you know, that Michael Osterholm, who's an epidemiologist, who's advising Joe Biden. Okay, he's not a nobody. He's one of the great hysterics about this, and he's, you know, wait 6 to 14 weeks now, wait for the spring. Remember, there's going to be a twindemic, there was going to be a Christmas surge, there were going to be, the deaths all over the South was going to be overrun over the summer. This has been going on for so long now, it is hard to almost remember how many times these people have been wrong. And again, we have issues with COVID. We have to have make sure our hospitals can manage it. But you know, there's never been a situation in the United States in the last year where regional hospital systems have been close to collapse. Okay, the field, you don't hear about field hospitals anymore, right? Because they basically went unused. What you hear is that that doctors and nurses are working hard, and they are working hard, and we should be thankful to them for that, and we should pay them well, and we should respect them. But this is a medical problem, not a societal problem. We've made it a societal problem.
I want to go back to what we started the conversation about, which is sort of those who don't have the proper opinion of, say, your former employer, the New York Times, get marginalized. The firing of Donald McNeil from the New York Times, and this was, you know, people rallying in defense. This is part of the purge. Apparently he was fired because a couple of years ago he used a racial slur in a conversation with a colleague about what racial slurs you shouldn't use, like this one. But the context, of course, doesn't matter. But I also have crocodile tears for Don McNeil, because it turns out that he was one of the, and he's the science reporter for the New York Times, or was, he was one of the early hysterics on this, with all sorts of apocalyptic statements that turned out not to be true. And Jeffrey Tucker over at American Institute for Economic Research had a good write-up on some of the things he said in the spring of last year, where he believed that we needed, you know, Zeke Emanuel-style lockdowns for 18 months, and he predicted the 2.5% mortality rate, so about 25 times the actual rate, and so on and so forth. This was one of the lead hysterics, and so I just want to include that, because I see some people talking about this as, you know, an example of the purge. Well, number one, anybody gets fired from the New York Times, you know, I have little empathy. Number two, just as a matter of course. And number two, this guy, you know, with his outsized platform based on his understanding of the situation, is culpable for the hysteria that has taken hold in some quarters where people are, you know, beyond the reach of reason.
So Don McNeil wasn't the worst, but he, you know, he did have a huge platform, and he was one of the members of a Team Apocalypse. He was, you know, he's not Eric Ding, but he pushed, and he wrote stuff that was wrong. And by the way, back in May of last year, he called for Dr. Redfield to be fired from the CDC. So he's not afraid to call for people to be canceled and fired. So, you know, look, should he have been forced out for using that word in the context he used it? No, but this is the times in which we live. And once it became public, I was pretty sure that his job was, you know, was done. Even though the Times obviously didn't want to let him go. That's where we are right now. And so, I think all of us who believe in truth, and look, there may be things I'm wrong about. There may be things you're wrong about, Dan. There may be things you're wrong about, Amy.
Yeah.
But we are speaking our minds and trying to be honest, and we should be allowed to debate and present our opinions. And it is wrong to try to force, you know, to try to force you not to speak, to try not to talk about a book of mine because you don't like what I'm saying about COVID. This we need to say this shouldn't happen anymore.
And we need not worry about cannibals being cannibalized. Alex Berenson, at Alex Berenson, follow him on Twitter, former New York Times reporter, author of the number one bestseller, Unreported Truths About COVID-19 and Lockdowns, three parts, death counts, lockdowns, and masks. You want to pick that up. And also his new novel, The Power Couple, a novel that was just released this week. Alex, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, and we're going to pick up your book. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And Amy, as you know, my favorite holiday is coming up. Amy?
And that's...
Is Amy there?
Valentine's
Amy?
Day?
That's Arbor Day. It's the end of April.
Oh.
I'm so fond of Arbor Day, because you think Arbor Day, you think trees, you think golf. But no, there is another holiday coming up, Valentine's Day, as you mentioned. And since I fancy myself a bit of a relationship expert, you know, as an avocation, not professionally.
Yes.
I thought maybe we should check in on people's marriages during COVID, as we're basically, this is the... about the 1 year anniversary of it, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So
it's not going so well.
So there's this piece in Washington Times from Kimberly Holmes. You may know her as the CEO of Marriage Helper. Sure.
Of course, yes. Consults her all the time. Every day. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She notes that from an American Family survey, 34% of Americans overall say the pandemic has increased stress in their marriage. For those households that face economic setbacks, the number rises to 45% who are facing increased stress in their marriage. A major online legal provider announced they've seen a 34% increase in requests for divorce paperwork, and newly married couples make up...
That's the worst.
Yeah, newly married couples make up a fifth of those requests.
Yeah, the till death do us part, for better or for worse, didn't sign up for that.
And, of course, you have many of the cultural Marxist mavens in the press corps extolling the virtues of divorce over the many months, arguing that, it's a way for people to address underlying struggles that have been bubbling for some time and so on and so forth, that divorce can be a cleansing event and so forth. So I just wonder how people's marriages are in advance of this Hallmark holiday, but really during COVID and against the backdrop of those stats. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
And if you are married, how are you making it work? I mean, that's a lot of bodies in one house for what was supposed to be 14 days, which is now 332 days. I mean, there's a lot of stress, and not only on the internet, in your house, but a lot of stress on, just people living on top of each other. And people that used to travel for a living, husbands that were gone 3 to 4 times a week, that travel has completely stopped. So I know that has affected a lot of marriages, because then you turn around and look at your partner like, ooh, I didn't sign up for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Is that rude?
And then
it's like
you,
when the house isn't big enough, you know.
And then you consult, those left-wing cultural Marxists, the outlets that are populated by cultural Marxists, and you get the palliative care that you need. Divorce is on the rise during the pandemic. Don't feel guilty if that includes you. Divorce doesn't automatically mean your kid will be damaged. In fact, it may even have benefits for our children, including resilience, spending quality time with each parent, and having increased empathy. This, an article featured in Parents Magazine. It's interesting because
they spin divorce as something positive.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because the research suggests that 50% of children do not see their father within 1 year of divorce. After 10 years, 2/3 of fathers no longer had any contact with their children. And research conducted over 15 years, longitudinal study, show that children whose parents divorced immediately began to suffer from behavioral problems that lasted, whose parents divorced immediately began to suffer from behavioral problems that lasted for years after the divorce. So I don't know that the actual evidence squares with this, hey, embrace divorce, run to it. But, I understand it happens. And, if I can do my part to repair some relationships, noting my expertise in this area, then, I want to do that.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. And if your marriage is doing well, we would love to hear from you, too.
Yeah.
What are some tips that you have?
There you go. Grant in Rockford, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. You too. Long time no talk. Disillusioned with politics. But the wife
marriage?
And I, believe it or not, ours is doing really good. We're on our 9th year this year, and life, it's good. We had to make some adjustments, not used to seeing each other 16 hours a day, but it'll do fine, and it's been so good that I'm actually scheduled to go get neutered next month. So, I've had enough kids.
Well,
so
I just want you to wear a nice cone around your head, okay, because we don't want you to scratch where it itches.
Well, yeah. You got to keep me from licking myself and scratching. So I'm going to heavily medicate. You guys have a good one.
Thanks for the call. Now, when that happens, is it like getting your tonsils out where you get as much ice cream as you want?
Exactly, sure.
Some sort of treat.
You have to sit on some cold pee bags.
Ralph and Rantoul.
Good morning, Dan, and I need to remind you that that's Rafe. And ever since I've changed that, my wife, I'm like a new man to her. She's just, things are really good in our marriage. We're expecting yet another child now, so that's good. And at my advanced age, that's an accomplishment.
How old are you, by the way, Ralph?
Personal. 75.
Seems improbable. But really, and that's child number which?
That would be child number imaginary, because we already raised one and got her out of the house. So, no, thank you. I think that changing the name has been the key to everything.
So your tip, thanks for the call, Ralph, your tip in terms of relieving marriage stress is just identify as someone else or something else.
Okay.
Oh, sure.
Well, it's weird because a lot of people, we didn't have an escape because the gyms were closed. Remember that? And then when the gyms, they closed them for a second time but didn't have group classes, churches closed, school was closed, no sports. The only thing that was open were casinos and strip clubs. And they're still open.
Those could could be stress inducers or stress relievers.
Exactly.
I guess, depending on how you visit them. There is this story. You know, I think we did this last. I think this is a bit of an evergreen, or it's turning into one. The story about the San Antonio Zoo.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a bit of a stress reliever, where you can, for $5, the San Antonio Zoo will name a cockroach after your former significant other and feed it to a bird, reptile, or mammal. And if you're really are feeling vengeful,
bitter,
you can pay another $20 and have zookeepers feed a frozen rat to a reptile instead.
Yeah, they're doing that. And if you live in Chicago area, you can go to the Brookfield Zoo because they're doing the same thing.
Are they? So this is a zoo thing to keep the zoos afloat. Yeah. I see. And I suppose they're live streaming it like San Antonio Zoo is doing it. I also don't understand why it would have to be a former significant other. I would think that perhaps maybe this would be stress relief if there is stress in your marriage for your current significant other.
Yeah, the package includes, for $15 here at Brookfield Zoo, a certificate of naming that you can fill out and share with your ex or hang on your wall as a reminder that a cockroach now bears their name.
It's perfect for Valentine's Day, just in time. Dave in Elk Grove.
Hey, Dave. Dave.
Dave. Hold on, we'll put you on hold. We'll try again. Verlon on the south side.
Well, I want to tell you to ask the self-righteous Dr. Phil, but I think he's going through a divorce. Either he cheated or his wife cheated. I don't know. So how about going with my number two? The other self-righteous SOB. The other self-righteous SOB, Steve Harvey. He wrote a book. He thought he knew so much about women. But I think he's about to go through a divorce. So I guess, Dan, there's no hope.
Never divorced over here. Thanks for the call, Verlon.
Yeah, but you've never been married. So.
Well.
That's a good record.
It's called prevention.
Exactly.
It's being proactive. And
don't you know that love is patient and love is kind?
I have heard that. The one thing I also understand from Dr. Phil, just to convey this, in case people hadn't heard, problems are like pancakes. They have two sides.
Oh.
So keep that in mind. Maybe that'll help.
Thanks.
Rob in Hampshire.
Hey, Dan. How are you? Hey, Amy. How are you?
Good.
30 years been married. Just finished 30 years. Run a small business together. We're together every day. Oh. We've raised four boys and going through this whole pandemic thing. And it's just simply hard work. And my wife is a very, very lucky lady. And I hope she's listening. How about that?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for the call, Rob.
She got herself a good one over here. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, the marriages obviously work when the woman lucks out and gets a guy like Rob.
Exactly.
That makes it a lot easier, sure. Not every woman's so fortunate to have Rob. Monica and Lyle.
Hi. I just wanted to say that the COVID thing may have stressed me out personally, but as far as my husband and I relationship goes, it's been, I think, better in some cases than ever. As far as marital relations go, it's off the charts.
Really? So that doesn't sound like you're social distancing and wearing masks, or maybe you are wearing masks, but not social distancing.
Not those kind of masks.
Boy, I set you up for that, didn't I? I set you up for that beautifully. Way to knock it out of the park. Thank you, Monica. Wow. Spicy in Lyle. Jim in Naperville.
Pretty. You know, I'm too cheap to pay a zoo for anything. You know, ain't time now. What I do is I just drop a dead mouse in my wife's mouth while she's sawing logs next to me.
Okay. All right, Jim. That probably runs afoul of the law if your wife was interested in pressing charges. Just some free legal advice while I'm giving relationship advice.
Okay.
Luke in Northbrook.
Luke.
Hey, Luke. Luke.
Is it line four that they just can't hear us?
I don't know. Let's try Luke again. Luke?
Let's see.
No, Luke.
Justin, maybe can you take Luke?
Do you have any advice and counsel you would like to provide, Amy?
Don't
do it.
Female
perspective. I mean, I kind of am the alpha and the omega here.
I cover
both grounds because I'm in touch with my feminine side.
Just make sure you have time to yourself is my best advice.
Honestly, be alone. The key to a good marriage.
What I do, I like to sit in my used minivan, my hobo ride, as I call it, and just kind of stay out of the house as much as possible.
Yeah.
So why do you want to go in there?
Here's some other advice.
You can pet feral cats that eats up some time in the day.
Sure. Here's some other advice, and this is of the Dr. Phil variety.
Yes.
You know, when people show you who they are, believe them. And I was just reminded of this over the last week, reading about Marilyn Manson. Marilyn Manson, the demonic pop star, you know, Beautiful People. And, he's been accused of all kinds of bad acts with respect to women, former girlfriends and stuff, that he was abusive and so forth, and that that he was demonic. Take a look at Marilyn Manson and tell me how you're surprised that that he has a bit of a dark side as is now being revealed to the world after 20 years of his alleged abuse. So when people show you who they are, you know, take them at their behavior. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.